On clear nights away from the city lights, we look up and see lots of stars, lots and lots of stars. And when we stop to think about how far away they are, and how many of them there are, we can feel small indeed. Thinking about the universe can force your mind to stretch a bit. Our guest this hour has been stretching his and helping to stretch ours for years now. Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist and cosmologist based at Caltech in Pasadena. He's written several books for both general and academic audiences. His previous book was The Particle at the End of the Universe. His latest, The Big Picture, arrives on store shelves officially next Tuesday. If Sean Carroll's name sounds familiar, this is the one who's been on the Colbert Report and not the one who teaches biology at the University of Wisconsin. Sean Carroll, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me on.
Anytime we talk physics, I'm reminded of Ernest Rutherford's quote about physics. Do you remember the one I'm talking about?
I certainly do. Yeah, I don't like to repeat it, but he did say that all of science is either physics or stamp collecting.
Which was a little mean to all the other sciences, but the fact is that when we understand physics a little better, we tend to understand the universe a bit better, don't we?
Well, you know, the Nobel Committee got back at him because Rutherford ended up winning the Nobel Prize in chemistry rather than physics. So that'll teach him to make those comments. But, you know, so I don't, in my book, I'm a theoretical physicist, and I talk a lot about biology and neuroscience and philosophy. But I'm not trying to stride into these fields and say, let me explain how it should be done because I'm smarter than you because I'm a physicist. I do think that different fields should be talking to each other. So I'm not trying to tell biologists how to do their job. I'm trying to talk about how physics and biology relate to each other. There's an enormous amount that we don't know yet about how all these different fields fit together, but they're all describing the same underlying universe. So that's what I'm trying to explore in the book.
So what was the starting spark for organizing the book and its information the way you ended up doing it?
Well, organizing it was tough, actually, because there's a lot of different ways to put all of these different pieces together. But, you know, roughly speaking, there's a logical way of telling the story where you start with our kind of what is unfortunately labeled our most fundamental understanding of the world, the sort of particle physics and cosmology way of looking at the world, the ingredients that make up us at a fundamental, most microscopic level. And then seeing how these evolve through time, so start talking about the evolution of the universe from the Big Bang to today and into the future. And then part of what happens as the universe evolves through time is that complex structures appear, like planets, like galaxies, like living beings here on Earth. And some of those complex living beings start thinking about themselves. So you start talking about consciousness and how the brain works. And finally, once you get all of that put together, you can ask, okay, so what do I do with it? You know, what good is it? What does it all mean to me in my everyday life?
So we get the beginning of the universe and the meaning of life all in one large volume?
Yeah, I skipped some of the details. I just weren't ahead of time, but the basic picture is there.
Well, you know, when you mention about creatures thinking about themselves, Rene Descartes is in the book a lot, you know, famous for I think, therefore I am. So this really is, I don't know how best to approach this, but we get to a point where having a consciousness becomes a factor that seems somewhat apart from the laws of physics.
It does seem that way. You know, certainly just going through the world, interacting with living beings at all, and conscious creatures in particular, seems to be a different kind of thing than interacting with, you know, rocks or oceans or something like that. And so it's very, very natural to ask ourselves the question, is there something that is truly fundamentally separate about consciousness or life from the inorganic world around us? And so I would say that 500 years ago, it would have been the most sensible thing in the world to treat those as utterly different kinds of things. But the progress of human knowledge over the past several hundred years has been one of unifying different-looking things. And I think our best understanding of consciousness or life right now is as an emergent phenomenon, something that is built out of the fundamental building blocks of everything else, the basic atoms that are just obey the laws of physics just like everything else does.
So does that mean that given the same set of physical laws across the universe, that consciousness is a logical result of all that?
It's not a necessary result, but it's a compatible result. Mm-hmm. It's something that the prospect was always there, and we are fortunate enough to live in a universe where that prospect came true, you know, that it actually made things like us. And I do talk a little bit in the book about how that shouldn't be a surprise that the natural evolution from the Big Bang to today would, it's very natural in retrospect that you get these complicated creatures and they eventually do develop self-awareness and ultimately consciousness. We are very far away from understanding all the details about how that happened, but it does fit into the big picture very nicely.
So when you talk about the natural evolution, I mean, the laws of physics are immutable, aren't they? I mean, have they been the same since the Big Bang, or do we think that some things have changed a bit since that time?
Well, we're open-minded about that. We test that. I've done research on this myself. We put forward ideas like maybe the laws of physics were different a few minutes after the Big Bang. And that's a testable idea because a few minutes after the Big Bang, the universe was a nuclear reactor. It was undergoing fusion reaction, turning protons and neutrons into helium and lithium. And you can look today at how much it produced and compare that to the predictions. The answer is it's spot on into what you would expect the universe to have done if the laws of physics were the same. So to the best of our current ability, it looks like in the observable universe, the laws of physics have been the same all along. But we're still very open-minded about, you know, maybe there could be small changes we haven't detected yet. And perhaps outside the universe we can see, in parts of the universe that we can't see because they're just too far away, maybe the laws of physics are very different.
Sean Carroll's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, theoretical physicist and cosmologist based at Caltech in Pasadena. His most recent book is called The Big Picture, on the origins of life, meaning, and the universe itself. Nothing too big here today. We'll come back and talk more with Sean and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Sean Carroll, who teaches theoretical physics and astrophysics at the Walter Burke Institute for Theoretical Physics at Caltech in Pasadena. He's the author of several books, including the not quite yet released The Big Picture, on the origins of life, meaning, and the universe itself. So we have a bit of a broad canvas to work on today. You can join us on the Exchange with your questions for Dr. Carroll and questions, comments as well, if you've got some stories to bring in here. 800-838-3760 over the phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I'm struck by the fact that your website for your blog and all that is called preposterousuniverse.com, which is a great name, but I mean, when you say preposterous universe, what do you mean?
Well, I mean that, you know, when we look at the universe, even before we've seen different parts of it or different aspects of it, we have expectations, right? There are suspicions, predictions that we make, and sometimes we don't get it right. There are aspects of the universe that, to our best understanding today, seem preposterous to us. One of the most obvious is the existence of dark matter and dark energy, the stuff that is most of the energy density of the universe. Now, it's a bit of an ironic joke, of course, because the universe isn't really preposterous. It's just that our understanding of it is incomplete. So I chose preposterous universe just as a reminder that there's plenty about the universe that we have yet to figure out.
Well, when you talked just before the break about the concept of maybe the laws of physics are different farther out, places we can't reach, I mean, what would be the best tool if you had one available to you today to be able to determine the kinds of things that you just don't know the answers to at this point?
Well, I think there's two things. I mean, as a practical matter, our theories right now are just not up to snuff in terms of making predictions for what the universe should look like. Does it go on forever looking more or less like it does nearby, or does the universe look very, very different far away? These are just not questions we have good answers to. So we're trying to improve our theoretical understanding that way. The other thing, of course, is to hope and pray that there is some observable consequence of these other kinds of laws of physics far away. So, for example, it's conceivable that universes could appear in bubbles, in spherical regions of space that expand and might even bump into each other. In that case, our early universe, the Big Bang that we sort of see the remnants of in the background radiation filling space, that might have been affected by one of these other universes bumping into us. So this is something that cosmologists actively look for. We go and search the cosmic microwave background radiation for signs of other universes having bumped into us long, long ago.
Just over the course of your career, Sean, have there been developments that have made your work, have allowed you to take your work further down the road?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's been a good couple of years recently, right? We discovered the Higgs boson in 2012. That was the final piece of the puzzle for what we call the core theory, the basic rules governing the atoms and particles and forces out of which you and I are made. We discovered gravitational waves from in-spiraling black holes just a few months ago. Perhaps the most surprising result in my own field was 1998, when we discovered that the universe is not only expanding, but accelerating. If you look at a distant galaxy, not only will it be moving away from you, but it's moving away from you faster and faster, which means that there's some energy in empty space that is pushing the universe apart. That is something we don't understand, that we really love to understand, and people like me are sort of trying to wrap our minds around that phenomenon.
Was the assumption always that things got flung out there at roughly the same rate, near and far?
Well, the assumption was that the universe is expanding, so galaxies are moving apart, the space in between the galaxies is growing, but there's also a gravitational pull. The galaxies are all pulling on each other, and that would act to slow down the expansion. Like when you throw a ball up into the air, it rises up into the air, but it slows down because of the Earth's gravitational pull. So this is as if you throw a ball up into the air and it slows down for a while, but at some point it begins to speed up away from the Earth, and that's sort of a bizarre thing that we haven't quite understood yet.
Okay, so the concept you just mentioned about gravitational waves, I mean, so help us understand that one. Gravity comes in waves?
Absolutely. You know, if you think about what gravity is, if there's some star far away from us, even if it's far away, there's some very slight gravitational pull that it has. And if something makes that star move back and forth, then the direction in which we're being pulled varies over time, right? As the star moves back and forth, we're pulled one way and another. So that time-dependent force of gravity is a gravitational wave. It's exactly the same as you take an electron, you move it back and forth, and it gives off an electromagnetic wave, which is what we see as light. So gravitational waves are just the gravitational equivalent of light, moving vibrations in the gravitational field.
Well, that was well explained. I get it now in a way that I didn't yesterday. We are talking to Sean Carroll from Caltech. His latest book is The Big Picture on the Origins of Life, Meaning, and the Universe Itself. Is this a good time to talk science to a general audience? I mean, on the one hand, you have Neil deGrasse Tyson, who gave a blurb for your book, I should point out, who seems to get TV viewers no matter what he does. On the other hand, you have a theme park that is putting Jesus with the dinosaurs.
You know, I think that if the optimistic spin on that is that people care. People are interested in these questions, even if for whatever local reasons they temporarily have the wrong answers. People do want more than just to get through the day and, you know, survive to live another day. They're curious. That's what human beings are. We want to know how our universe works. So I think there's a huge audience for science in the public imagination, everywhere from the Big Bang Theory on TV to very advanced books and science documentaries. I think that the more we give people, the more excited they are about it.
You're a science advisor to several TV shows. The Big Bang Theory is one of them, isn't it?
The Big Bang Theory, you know, I chatted with those people a little bit. They have a full-time science advisor, David Salzberg, who is a professor at UCLA. But yeah, you know, you get calls. If you live in LA as a working physicist, you will occasionally get calls for movies and TV shows to help you fix up their science a little bit.
And do they often take the suggestions you put? Or, if, I mean, given a push, a give and take between real science and a good joke, will they always go with the good joke?
Always go with the good joke, yes. And you know, you can't blame them. I think that if you're talking about a movie or a TV show, the point is to tell a good story. You know, it's different than a science documentary. So it always has to be the science in the service of the story. And the point is, in my mind, that doing good science on TV or movies actually does improve the story. Getting the real world correct adds to the verisimilitude of the story you're trying to tell. So everyone wins if you try to get the science right.
Let's take a call. We have Dennis in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sean Carroll from Caltech, the author of The Big Picture.
Hi. Say, here's my dilemma. It seems to me that everything that we think science is because we're thinking it. And what I'm trying to say is, if a being from another planet came here and was perfectly able to survive and live on this planet, but its makeup, its physical makeup, was completely and totally different than ours, that being's idea of what is would be probably completely and totally different than ours. So it seems like to me it's all related to your basic physiological makeup, how you think.
How your own body is constructed dictates how you think?
Yeah, it's just, if we were, everything that we perceive, we've created on in our own minds ourselves. I mean, there's no way to test it in the big universe, because we don't even know what the big universe is yet. We know what we know, but we don't. Look at how everything changes so fast. So I just don't think that we can say this is a law or that's a law, because a lot of times it turns out it is.
All right. Thanks for that, Dennis. Appreciate it. So some thoughts on that, Sean?
You know, I wouldn't quite agree all the way. I mean, I think that there is a certain perspectivalism that comes when you try to understand the universe. You know, who you are, where you start from, what you already believe certainly affects what you learn next. But there's also an enormous constraint based on the fact that the world is the world, and the world is the same world for everybody, and we do experiments and we collect the data. And over again, we see situations where people believed or wanted to believe something, but the data told them that wasn't the way it was, so we had to change our minds. You know, no one would have invented quantum mechanics or relativity just by thinking about it. You invent quantum mechanics and relativity because the experiments force you to do that. And I think that to a large extent, even aliens or very different life forms would invent the same laws of physics as we did, because they're doing experiments and they're going to get the same answers that we get.
I was also thinking, as Dennis was talking, that we may feel differently species to species, assuming there are other sentient species out there that can do what we do, about what's around us. But we ourselves are very different from what we were like 500, you know, or 1,000 years ago. We had very different ideas about what caused what in the world.
Yeah, we've come a long way. We've changed a lot, and part of the story that I tell in the book that, you know, we had a very, very different way of thinking about the world 2,000 or 2,500 years ago, and it was a rational way at the time. You know, it made perfect sense to the best of our knowledge then. We've really just had a complete revolution in our fundamental way of thinking about how stuff behaves in the world. And, you know, we're still trying to process that and to fit it in and to see how this understanding of the fundamental stuff of reality should percolate up into affecting how we live our everyday lives.
Let me remind listeners, you can join our discussion with Sean Carroll here on the Jefferson Exchange. Ask some questions, and there are many, and or share some stories of your own. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to get into some of the terms you use, not just in this book, but on a regular basis. The arrow of time, it certainly is a compelling sort of image. Tell us about what that means.
Yeah, the arrow of time is one of my favorite ideas. It's the very simple idea that time goes from the past to the future. You know, that standing here in the present moment, we think of the past and future as very different kinds of things, right? We have records of the past, memories of the past. The past has happened and it's already in the books, whereas in the future we make predictions, we make choices, and it hasn't happened yet. But the interesting thing is that nowhere in the laws of physics, at the deep down level, is this distinction drawn, that the laws of physics treat the past and future exactly the same. So the fact that we in our lives think that the past and future are very different is not a reflection of the fundamental laws of physics. It's a sort of local feature of our cosmos, why we started from the Big Bang in a certain very special state and have been evolving ever since.
Poetic naturalism is another term you use. What does that mean?
Well, naturalism is a simple idea that there is only one world, the natural world, you know, the world that we investigate by making observations and doing experiments. But poetic is just a reminder that we talk about the world in different ways. We have a language of physics where we talk about atoms and molecules and forces. We have a language of biology where we talk about cells and their interactions. We have a language of human scale things, psychology and sociology and economics. And all of these stories can be true, and you can tell any one of them without knowing about the others. But at the same time, they better be compatible with each other. If your rules of economics do not obey the laws of physics, then you're probably on the wrong track.
All right. On that note, let's take a call from Will in Arcata. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sean Carroll from Caltech.
Hi. I have a strange question about what you would say to the concept or how you would address it of putting the scientific method to politics to try to figure it out for the mass of the people, because it seems like most people are very confused. You know, they have questions, which always leads me to science, like try to figure things out about, you know, how do we get like a total CIA created president and the CIA running all these things in the world, but people don't seem to really understand it, or like the Trilateral Commission. What do you think about applying the scientific method with scientists, like actually trying to address these things? Because I look at it as like, yeah, we're looking at life on Earth or in other planets, but everything's going to go extinct if we don't address this problem of the people that are demolishing it.
Hard science and political science. Interesting concept, Will. Thanks for that. Sean, what do you think?
Well, I think that there are some basic ideas that are common to science and to other ways of addressing the world. So the whole second part of my book is entitled Understanding, because it's about how we learn about the world. And part of it is humility, right? We don't assume that we can just figure it out by thinking. We propose different hypotheses, and then we test them against the data. And this works in science, and it should work in everyday life, in politics, in economics, in whatever. That doesn't mean that actual scientists are the ones who should be ruling the world, because scientists are trained to do science, which is a very, very different thing than setting up a society that is well-functioning.
There's a section in Understanding where you ask the question, what exists and what is illusion, which having had a number of discussions with neuroscientists, this is important, it seems like, because it's not just how we perceive the universe, but what is in the universe. These are very different things, or certainly can be, because we filter so much through our own perceptions. So are we seeing the universe as clearly as we should or can?
Well, we try to do better and better. There's certainly parts of the universe that we don't see very clearly. We only sort of perceive them indirectly. We live in a world, in a universe, which is 95% dark stuff, dark matter and dark energy. And what we mean by that is it's stuff that has not been made here on Earth, not detected, touched directly in a laboratory. It's only inferred because it has a gravitational effect on the universe. We can notice its gravitational field even though we don't see it directly. So we would certainly love to be able to have more direct access to this part of the universe. And, you know, in some sense, there has to be some way of noticing things in the universe if they're to be relevant at all. You know, if something is literally unnoticeable, then it doesn't play a big role in how the universe functions. The interesting part is the aspects like dark matter and dark energy that have an indirect influence that is hard to notice, but once you do notice them, you're going to try to do better to find them directly. So, for example, trying to directly detect dark matter is a huge part of the agenda for physics over the next 10 years.
How do you even develop the methods to find something that you can't see or perceive other than by its effect on something else?
Well, it's actually, you know, part of what we call quantum field theory. This is another thing I talk about in the book that is a great organizing framework for modern physics. The world is made of fields. You know, you have the gravitational field, the electric field, the magnetic field. Even the particles that you know about, the electrons, neutrinos, quarks, and so forth, these are all vibrations in quantum fields. And it's kind of like, you know, a sound in a room from a musical instrument if there are other instruments sitting in the room. If you play a note on a piano, another piano nearby is going to resonate along with it. It's going to hum along with it at that note. The fields are the same way. Once you start one field in the universe vibrating, the other ones sort of know about it, and you can start them vibrating as well. That's how we made the Higgs boson, right, at the Large Hadron Collider. We didn't start with Higgs bosons and find them. We made them. We started the Higgs field vibrating by colliding protons together at enormous energies. So So you want to do the same thing with dark matter. You know, it clearly interacts with gravity. So we're hopeful, we cross our fingers, that it interacts in some other way. Maybe it interacts directly with matter through one of the nuclear forces. Maybe it doesn't. We don't know. But that's the hypothesis that we put forward, and then we go try to test it in the lab.
Sean Carroll, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book, The Big Picture, on the origins of life, meaning, and the universe itself. His previous book is The Particle at the End of the Universe. He's been down this road a bit before and sharing it with a general audience in The Big Picture. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange. We will take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more with Sean and take phone calls and emails from you in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Sean Carroll from Caltech, theoretical physicist and cosmologist and author of many books, including the brand new The Big Picture on the origins of life, meaning, and the universe itself. So a lot to talk about here on the Exchange today, but you're more than welcome to join in the conversation with some questions for the doctor or some stories of your own about the ways in which you have perceived the universe. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You just mentioned the Higgs boson, which was the topic of your previous book, The Particle at the End of the Universe. For the folks who are still sort of trying to wrap their minds around it, what is the importance of the Higgs boson?
Well, you know, it doesn't have any kind of technological or economic importance. We're not going to build a better smartphone now that we found the Higgs boson. But it has enormous importance for how we think about the world. It was the final piece of the puzzle in what we call the core theory, the fundamental rules that govern the atoms and forces of which you and I are made. Without the Higgs boson, the rest of what we understand about particle physics just wouldn't make any sense. It was one of those things we were almost sure had to be there, because the Higgs boson pervades space and changes the properties of other particles that we do know and love, like electrons and quarks and so forth. So we were very glad to find it, and now that we've found it, we're going to put it to use trying to discover new particles beyond what we think is already there.
All right, so from particles to strings, I figured somebody would ask this. Jeannie in Medford dropped off the question about string theory and whether it's relevant.
String theory is relevant if you want to understand how gravity and quantum mechanics play together. And I want to understand that. You know, you may or may not care about that, but I think that this is one of the fundamental issues facing modern physics, how to reconcile Einstein's theory of general relativity, our best understanding of gravity. Gravity is the curvature of space-time, according to Einstein, and how to make that compatible with what we understand about the quantum world, which applies very, very well to microscopic physics, to atoms and individual particles, and hasn't yet encompassed gravity, which is one of the most obvious things about our macroscopic world. So string theory is the leading candidate for bringing together quantum mechanics and gravity. That doesn't mean it's right. It just means it's the best idea that we have on the market right now.
Well, the calls are starting to pile up here. Let's go to Steve and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sean Carroll.
Howdy. A while back, some scientists were postulating the idea of multiple universes, either layered on top of each other or existing separately. Has this picked up and gone anywhere, or is it fallen by the wayside?
All right. Thanks for the question.
Yeah, I think that the multiverse idea, the cosmological multiverse, is one that's gotten a lot of attention from modern cosmologists. It's a bit of a mixed bag. I think that there are, on the conceptual level, a lot of good reasons to take the multiverse idea seriously. It's not just that people said, well, maybe there's a lot of universes. It came out as a prediction of other ideas that people were investigating for totally other reasons. At the same time, you know, it's hard to know whether something like that is true or false. So it's this point of investigation where our theories are just not yet good enough for us to really be confident one way or the other. You know, we should just be humble and say, we don't know right now whether far away, the universe looks very different and almost looks like a different kind of universe entirely.
Well, when scientists talk about multiverses, though, is it the same as comic book writers talking about multiverses, which are universes that exist in the same space but just vibrate at different frequencies?
It is not the same. In fact, even scientists use words that sound very similar to each other but in different ways. So in quantum mechanics, we talk about many worlds. We say that, you know, if it's some electron that could be spinning clockwise or counterclockwise, quantum mechanics says it could be both at once. It could be in a superposition of spinning one way and the other at the same time. But when you observe it, you only see either clockwise or counterclockwise. And the many worlds idea says that when you observe it, really both possibilities become true, but in two separate worlds. There's one world in which it was spinning clockwise and you saw it spinning clockwise, another world in which it was spinning counterclockwise and you saw it spinning counterclockwise. So that's a whole other kind of multiverse, really. They're sort of, the worlds really are next to each other in some conceptual sense. There's no physical distance between them. Whereas in cosmology, the multiverse is much more literal and grounded and down to earth. It's just like over there, far away, there are conditions that are very different in our local environment. So we're going to call that as if it were another universe.
Here's another call from Glenn in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, I think it'd be kind of interesting for Dr. Carroll to talk about the Fermi paradox. Maybe he could explain that to the listeners. And his thoughts on the odds of having other spacefaring colonizing civilizations in the universe.
All right. Thanks for that, Glenn.
Yeah, this is a fascinating feature of how we think about the world and our galaxy in particular. So Enrico Fermi was a brilliant Italian-American scientist, one of the last scientists really in physics, who is both a world-class experimenter and theorist. And one of the things he theorized about is he realized that even though the galaxy is big, you know, our Milky Way galaxy has hundreds of billions of stars scattered over tens of thousands of light years, it would take a long time to visit all those stars or to travel from one end of the galaxy to the other. But it's actually a short time compared to the age of the universe. You know, even if it takes several million years to fill the galaxy, the galaxy has been here for billions of years. So if there had been any extraterrestrial civilization that grew up a billion years ago that survived long enough to sort of send out spaceships and move through the galaxy, they should have filled the galaxy a long time ago. It should be very, very easy to notice that there are extraterrestrial civilizations out there. And in fact, we look and we don't see them. I mean, they might be there in some more subtle way, but they're very, very far from obvious. So the Fermi paradox is just, why isn't the universe or our local region of the universe alive with intelligent life in a very obvious way? So who knows what the answer is? The simplest answer is just that either life is very, very rare, it just doesn't happen that much, or even if life is common, intelligent, technologically advanced life is rare. We really have no idea what fraction of the time life is going to arise on a planet. And or what fraction of the time when life does arise, does it gain intelligence and technology and the ability to build spaceships? We have no idea. So those numbers could be very small. The other sort of more intriguing possibility is that there are plenty of intelligent civilizations in the galaxy, and for some reason they choose not to explore. They choose not to visit other places. And we don't know what that reason would be, but we should, again, be humble about that. You know, we're barely at the very first tippy-toe step of what it means to explore space. So us proclaiming knowledge about what should and should not happen once we get the ability to visit other stars is a little bit premature.
Email here from Scott in Ashland. He says, as I understand it, physicists generally agree that the universe originated about 13.8 billion years ago. We have seen light from galaxies that were about 13.3 billion light years away, meaning that to travel that distance, the light we are seeing left them 500 million years into the existence of the universe. Does that mean that in its first 500 million years, the universe had expanded so that it was over 13.3 billion light years in extent? That would seem to suggest that the universe expanded at a rate much faster than the speed of light. Am I missing something? Says Scott in Ashland.
Well, your numbers are more or less right, but sadly, the expanding universe is just a complicated, subtle thing to try to understand. So when the universe was younger, it was also smaller. Things were closer together. So when you even ask the question, you know, how much distance has a beam of light traveled from a distant galaxy to us, you can say with some confidence, okay, it left, let's say, 13 billion years ago. But to say how much distance it traveled is much harder than that, because it's a moving target. You know, we were much closer to that galaxy when the light left. We're far away from it now, and you really have to consider all of the change in the size of the universe during that travel time. So it does not mean that anything was moving faster than the speed of light or anything like that. All it means is that the size and shape of the universe has been changing, and now that light beam that left that galaxy finally had the chance to reach us.
When I was just about to ask about whether it's even possible in theory to travel faster than the speed of light, I realize that you know, paying attention to science fiction can kind of mess you up for a science fact. I mean, how much does science fiction interfere with the public perception of what kinds of work you do?
Well, you know, I don't mind science fiction. I think it's great that people get excited about these ideas in whatever form they come in. I do think that there's a certain amount of wishful thinking that goes into science fiction, and also a certain amount of parochialism, because we take what we already know how to do, like travel through space, and imagine we can do it better, so we can travel through space faster and in bigger spaceships. That's the easy part of projecting into the future. But the laws of physics say we're never going to move faster than the speed of light. On the other hand, there's wholly new kinds of things that we'll be able to do that are much harder to anticipate. So it's easy to write a science fiction story about traveling faster than the speed of light, even though it violates the laws of physics. It's much harder to think about what are the consequences going to be of technology that changes our lifespans, and the way that artificial intelligence arises, and how human brains interact with computers and so forth, or even entirely new technological advances that we haven't even thought of yet. So I don't think that science fiction plays an important role in predicting the future. I think it plays an important role in inspiring and stimulating our imaginations to try to think about what the future might be like.
Call from Wayne in McKinleyville. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sean Carroll from Caltech.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I had a question. Back in the 1800s, scientists came up with the idea of ether to explain the material that light waves would travel through, because they could not imagine light waves traveling through empty space. I'm wondering if maybe this idea of dark energy and dark matter might be a similar theory that's come up to explain things that we can't see and can't understand and might not really even exist. And I wonder what Dr. Carroll thought about that.
Let's find out. Thank you, Wayne.
Well, it's a good question, but, you know, the answer is it's kind of the opposite of the ether. You know, the ether was an idea people had because they knew that light existed and light moved through the universe, but they didn't have any evidence of the actual ether. They didn't have any evidence of the effects that this stuff was supposed to have. It was a purely theoretical idea. And it was Einstein's great breakthrough to realize that all of the predictions that their theories were making would be just as good if they got rid of the idea of the ether. Things like dark matter and dark energy are the opposite. Nobody wanted them to be there. You know, no one was predicting them. They were forced on us by observations. By the fact that we look at what the universe is doing, we see galaxies moving in certain ways, the universe expanding in certain ways, and the dark matter and dark energy are the simplest explanation that we have for what we see. Now, that doesn't mean that they're right. We're not done. We haven't established these beyond any possible doubt. We're trying to detect these things directly in experiments and observations. And we could come up with a better idea. You know, maybe there's another reason why the universe is accelerating that is not dark energy. We're very, very open to that. But it's not at all that, you know, scientists were on the dark energy bandwagon or just making excuses for it. We're forced into the corner, and this is what we seem to be forced to believe in.
Sean, in our final 2 minutes, I want to get to the part of the book about complexity, where you explain the universe in a cup of coffee. What happens there?
Well, it's an interesting fact that, you know, the difference between past and future, the arrow of time, is ultimately due to the increase of entropy in the universe. Entropy being the scientific idea of disorderliness or disorganization. The world becomes more disorganized over time. It started very, very organized, very orderly, and that dissipates as time goes on. So that's great. It explains a lot, but it raises this question, you know, if all the universe is doing is becoming more disorderly, why in the world do intricate, complex structures like human beings come into existence or life forms at all? So that's because the entropy being high or low is just a whole different thing than complexity versus simplicity. And you can see this in the cup of coffee. The cup of coffee, if you imagine the cream and the coffee being separate, that's low entropy, that's organized. Cream on top, coffee on bottom. It's also simple. It's just cream is there and the coffee is there. When you mix them all together, that's high entropy. They're all mixed together. That's not going to be undone. That's as mixed up as it can get. But it's also simple. It's just a homogeneous mess of cream and coffee, right? It's in between. It's when your spoon is mixing that cream into the coffee and you see the tendrils of cream moving their way into the coffee in some kind of intricate fractal pattern. That's in between low entropy and high entropy, but it's the maximum value of complexity. So complexity naturally arises as the universe evolves. And that's just not coffee, that's you and me as well.
I was thinking that's a good metaphor for society as well, so that's a good place to leave it. The book is called The Big Picture, On the Origins of Life, Meaning, and the Universe Itself. Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist and cosmologist at Caltech, and he wrote it and he joined us on The Exchange today. Sean, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Take care.